This week on Barbell Shrugged, we interview founder of CrossFit Endurance, Brian McKenzie.
Hey, this is Rich Froning. You're listening to Barbell Shrugged. For the video version, go to barbellshrugged.com.
Welcome to Barbell Shrugged. I'm Mike Bledsoe, standing here with Doug Larson, Chris Moore, our CTP behind the camera. And we're here at Paleo FX in Austin, Texas, the coolest conference around in regard to strength, conditioning, nutrition, fitness, health, all that mess. We're standing here with Brian McKenzie.
Hello.
Welcome back, dude.
Yes.
Good to be back, dude.
And what are you most well known for? We got CrossFit Endurance.
CrossFit Endurance.
That's probably right.
That cool tattooed guy who does the running.
Yeah, the really tattooed guy.
Yeah. The 3Fuel shirt on.
I got 3Fuel representing.
Representing. And we're hanging out in Caveman Coffee and getting caffeinated.
Getting highly caffeinated.
highly caffeinated. we were talking earlier. Well, before we do that, go to barbellshrug.com. It's time for the newsletter. Yes. All right.
All kinds of secrets will make their way to your inbox. And you'll become the coolest guy in your gym and also the strongest and most handsome.
What about for the ladies? What are they going to get?
The exact opposite things that women want most in life. They get those things.
So we were talking about you've been looking at athletes recently in the functional fitness space.
Yes.
That aerobic capacity may not be maybe underdeveloped, and it's hurting them in the gym. It's hurting them in competition. It's hurting them in life.
Yeah, I think it's something I've actually looked at for quite a while. And coming from my background, having endurance training in it, you know, there's always been this, you came into CrossFit with this aerobic base, and it's like, well, I came into CrossFit actually doing high intensity work, a lot of it, but it was actually done in a manner that, you know, we were observing everything so that we weren't falling apart. And it's not that there's any problem with CrossFit in that manner. It's the fact that I think people gravitate largely in this world, or even in the CrossFit endurance realm, where they see an interval popped up on the site, you know, twice a week and then a longer run. And it's like, I'm just going to blast out these things. And it's like, well, there's actually reason to doing these things. And there's more substance to them than just blasting something out. And so we, you know, in doing a lot of the testing that we've done and a lot of the research, we've seen a ton of problems with aerobic capacity. And this just so happens to be, you know, followed with, I fucking hate running too. And it's like, well, that's weird.
So how are you defining aerobic capacity, and what does having problems with it mean?
Well, I think having an aerobic ability, so that allowing you to, you know, within a testing spectrum, like let's just say we did a VO2 max test and you're watching the VO2 test and the heart rate's jumping up and down and all over the place as it goes through what should be your aerobic threshold. That being said, once we get into something like your anaerobic threshold or past it, it's just being completely redlined at that point, and you just muscle your way through everything. What I've seen is that largely not even doing a VO2 test, but more or less looking at something like a deflection test and seeing the deflection markers actually of where the heart is actually changing, where you're seeing some cardiovascular changes that are happening in the body. And for people who've spent enough time in this, they know and they feel these things, like the breathing changes through your aerobic threshold. The breathing then changes through your lactate threshold. The breathing then can change through going upwards of that.
What does that breathing look like? You say it changes, but what's it change from?
Desperation and business. I'm dying.
Well, so like you go from belly breathing to chest breathing?
That depends. See, there's where we're starting to see mechanical problems. When we see people who actually even start running and don't even have, like, they have mechanical issues to start. Let's just say somebody who's overextended, who's got an anterior pelvic tilt, they're not even using their diaphragm. They're just using their rib cage. They're just using the lungs to breathe. So they're missing something. So we know there's a mechanical issue. This can happen when you hit a threshold point as well, where you'll just start to see, and you'll nail, if you've seen enough, like, and you guys are pretty damn educated, so it's like you've done this stuff in school, where you will see when somebody hits that lactate threshold, mechanics start to change into something else, because I got to get fucking comfortable, because it's starting to get uncomfortable.
Right.
That said, it's you take and when you observe heart rate in that manner, you're watching how this marker is moving through these places, and when it makes big jumps or does these deltas, it's like, whoa, and then it drops out again, and then we see another delta, and it's another high delta. Okay, there it is again, and yet we haven't even, like, we're 140 beats in, like, not anywhere near somebody's max, and then they take their heart rate up to 190, and it's like, oh shit, like, we, there's a problem there. Like, we, you know, you could actually be pushing yourself a lot further along if you actually had this aerobic capacity so to handle that type of...
They're probably at like 80%, and they're starting to dig into a different energy system.
Oh, yeah.
So easy. They're digging into a... You're getting off of the aerobic base that could take you even further, which just means that your workout is going to be... You're going to do... If you're doing it for time, it's going to take you a lot longer.
Yes. And you're just going to hit walls where it's like, and we've all seen it. We've all probably been there. Hey, I start going hard and then I have to stop and my hands are on my knees and then I start again and then I have hands on knees. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, fuck, I just can't get, I'm a mess right now.
So you're suggesting that people can't fix that problem of going hard during a Metcon. You got to stop, take a break, put your hands on your knees and then jump back on the pull-up bar or whatever. They can't fix that by just doing more Metcons. They have to do something that's more specific.
Well,
or what are you saying?
Not necessarily. You actually probably could. But let's just take, you know, in one of the great analogies I like to use is Rich. Like, Rich understood this stuff from the get-go. Rich doesn't start off like in the blaze of glory.
No, he's like, ready to go. And he's like, Okay.
I would say astonishingly reserved at the start.
There you go.
Almost like, what's going on?
Yeah.
He's too calm, eerily calm.
Like,
eerily
I remember a couple years ago at regionals that it was like muscle-ups started everything. It was like something like 10 or something muscle-ups that started this big, huge chipper. Or 20 muscle-ups. And Rich started, everybody's just blasting through. And he's just like, one, two. And the guys are like on five or six. And I'm like, dude, these guys are going to fall apart.
Oh, yeah. They're peaking and then they're falling. Yeah. He's just even the whole time.
And then as it gets to the end, he's maxing out, but he's able to continue going. Mm-hmm. And this is what a lot of people don't understand. So back to your question or your point is, look, you can still do a Metcon, but if you're willing to take the time to understand where you need to pace this and how you need to pace this, that way you're not blasting through those levels or those ceilings and misunderstand and stopping or misunderstanding where you should be.
Right. You should never be anywhere close to redlining until like the last 30 seconds.
Yeah. Unless, of course, it's like something like, you know, a 1 minute effort or, you know, right? Hey,
you're being reserved is not really part of the equation.
It's just not part of the equation, dude. you know, most workouts, including something like Fran, which is being done in under 2 minutes by some of these top guys, it does require some pit. You can't just out of the gun go. I think 15.5 was the greatest representation of what CrossFit actually is. In a couplet. It's a push and it's a pull, and it's the most classic thing that's ever been devised with inside that realm, because people could, it's like, I'm going to go run a mile. You can get good at running a mile, but if you're going to do a mile, but it's like reversed half a quarter of the way in, and then you're going to go back, and then you're going to go back, and then you're going to go back. That's where this thing tested fitness, and we saw more people puking in 15.5 than we have in fucking 3 or 4 years, like we've heard about.
At home. Yeah, remind everyone what the
it was. 27, 21, 15, 9 reps for time of rowing for calories and thrusters.
Yeah.
Nauseating.
Yeah, just devastating, right?
It's nasty.
But getting people, like some of my athletes, to understand, we went over for the game plan. Dude, you start at about 80-85%. Start on that erg at 80-85% and maintain that, and so that you're not stopping and having to put the bar down.
Hitting failure is usually the worst idea, like during competition. Like if you're hitting failure on any, even if it's like handstand push-ups, maybe it's not even an aerobic thing. You're hitting like failure, and then now that time to recovery is going to be so much longer.
Yeah, and I think the handstand push-up is a great, great analogy of where people blow it. Like, I'm just going to max out my handstand push-ups right now in this first round, and it's over. Like, I'm not going back up again now.
Yeah.
Well,
gravity wins.
Yeah, gravity won on that one. But you know,
I was going to say, as we evolve and competition gets heavier and heavier and heavier, strength becomes more and more and more of a focus. So I was going to say, for you, do you get a lot of resistance with suggesting that aerobic capacity is really where people should be focusing? Do they come to you and say, well, of course you think that. You're the endurance guy. Of course you're going to tell me that. Like, what do people say to you?
I don't know that I've really I know I've been saying for a long time, I'm like, look, if you can have men and women at fairly high levels on a national level for weightlifting in CrossFit, but you've got 11 or 12-year-olds beating them in 5K and 10K times. Like, it, and that's for real. Like, top level junior high and even high school runners are blasting. And sure, they're incredibly specialized.
Yeah.
I get it. Like, but the fact is... On both sides. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you're going to need to have that endurance capacity. And we're finally starting to see that now where it's like, look, you're going to have to get that to catch up. And, you know, I'm even seeing with a lot of the athletes, like Danielle Horan, who I've been working with for the last 3 years, she is now finally really putting down an endurance program where she's thoughtfully, okay, I need to do this and hold this specific marker versus I'm just going to go do this.
Right.
What's a thoughtfully thought out program look like for endurance for like the functional fitness athlete, the CrossFitter?
Depending on what they can handle, it's anywhere from 3 to 5 or 6, even 6 days of endurance work. Now, what that entails, it is dependent upon the athlete, really. Where I see the holes or where we see the holes is the coach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hey, where are these holes that we have? Like, is this, you know, short, really short intervals where we're seeing this, you know, glycolytic state that doesn't, you know, she can't recover or he can't recover after some of these intervals? Or is it something more towards the lactate threshold? What does their capacity even look like? Where are their deflection markers at? And these are things that, like, I like to test for, like, every 4 to 6 weeks. Hey, you're going through a test again. Fuck.
What do these tests look like?
A deflection test, simply just doing something on like, let's just take a treadmill, for instance. We just take it, start it at like 3.5 miles an hour and bring it up half a mile an hour every minute and record the heart rate at the top of each minute.
Right.
And you go until you can't go anymore.
And then watch when things visibly break down, the wheels come
and
off.
And watch when you fall off the treadmill.
You see what's happening there? The wheels are coming off.
Yeah.
Oof. We need to take a picture of the face at each one, too. Sorry.
Minute 1, minute 2.
Deflection face syndrome.
It's always like, hey, just so you know, the first 6 or 7 minutes of this is going to be pretty. It's going to be pretty easy, but after that, shit's going to change, and that's exactly what happens. Is we just start to see things changing, and that's where we pick up those markers and go, hey, here's where you're deficient right now. We need to close the gap, you know, on your aerobic and anaerobic thresholds here. Like when we have aerobic thresholds that are in the 120s and then you've got a lactate threshold at 140 and a max heart rate, you know, I'm just kind of tossing
about
there.
Beats per minute heart rate.
Yeah, beats per minute heart rate. And then you've got a max heart rate at 182. Like, that's a fucking problem.
It sounds like this could be as obvious as some people just rounding over during front squats. I mean, if you are that bad compared to what is considered good for aerobic base, it's the easiest, lowest hanging fruit to make the biggest bang on your training.
Yes, this is the physiology of, you know, basically front squatting or whatever you want to talk about. Yeah, exactly.
You can't be that far off what is considered good for just the run of the mill person who's just running.
Yes.
I mean,
yeah.
Oh, God. Were those real numbers you just threw out there?
No, but I mean, okay, so one of my athletes who we tested probably 4 or 5 months ago, we threw him in there, and his aerobic threshold was at 125, I think, and lactate threshold was at 148, I believe. And he
test max heart rate on him too.
We maxed him out right there, so we just kept going until he quit, and we maxed him out at about 185-ish.
How old is he?
Well, that's the thing, is he wasn't recovered enough. So, and that's the other thing, is it's like what we're seeing with a lot of these athletes is it's like, hey, take a day off. Okay. They take a day off, they come in and they test, and it's like they can't, they're in the 90th percentile of their max heart rate, which is like, well, you can't even max right now. And you took a day off.
Yeah.
And that is also indicative of, I just want to train versus I want to absorb and train.
They're training a lot in the, maybe the wrong energy system, and they probably need to spend a little more time in aerobic and then spend some more time recovery.
And a lot of this stuff has really been talked about in the past with other people where it's like, oh, you're just going to see all this burnout and all this stuff. And it's like, well, that's, yes, that's what we are seeing. But that, I don't think that's ever been the intention of what CrossFit is. And in fact, we've seen high-level CrossFitters who get it and don't literally stay in that world of, I'm just going to lift heavy all week and not run. But I want to be a CrossFit athlete. And it's like, unfortunately, that's not going to work out with you the way you want to do it.
Yeah.
But with that even said, it's like we could even take a power lifter and even give him, like, put him through something like this and go, look.
Not, you point at me like it's going to happen. This is not going to happen. I've been talked into enough silly shit on this show, okay?
Hey.
Which means you smile, which means I'm probably going to end up doing it.
You moved to San Diego. You're in San Diego now, so it's like, yeah. Hey, you know. But the fact is it's like, look, we're hearing things from guys like John Wellborn. And like a lot of these heavy lifting guys that are like, fuck, I'm now doing a little bit of cardio, and I'm actually not only feel better, but I'm lifting more.
What is your official on that point? Now I'm curious because, like,
how much do I have to do?
This guy's talking my language. If you promise to make me stronger, I guess my primate response is, okay, coach, tell me what to do. But where would you start with your best recommendation for a guy who's like, look, you have a big gap here. You can stand to work on this, but you can't just jump
simply all the way in.
You can't jump all the way in all the
front. Yeah, I got you. 20 minutes on a station.
20 minutes?
Okay, hold on. Go 20 minutes on a stationary bike. Just cruising.
So I don't have to go anywhere.
You don't have to go anywhere. Or get on your beach cruiser.
20
now
minutes,
you live
just easy peasy, lemon squeezy. Yeah. I'm just pedaling. I'm just, you know.
And work that up every couple of weeks. Add another 20. Here's one of the things we like to do, though. Recover between the 20-minute efforts. So stop, recover, get your heart rate down low, start back up again. That way you're actually moving yourself through recovery and understanding if you are recovering quickly from this stuff.
It's good to measure things so you know how it feels.
Yes.
Like some of the top athletes, they're so tuned in their bodies, they know when they need to take a day off. They know when they need to not take it past 90% effort. They know all these things. But that's from a lot of times from pure experience, but also you can get there quicker if you've measured at some point. That's kind of what you're talking about. Like, all right, we're going to measure the heart rate. This is what it feels like. And you're like, oh. So like, a year later, you've been doing this. You don't have to look at the heart rate monitor to see, oh, I feel recovered or I know I need to settle down.
If you've done enough of your homework and you've actually experimented enough, you start to understand what that feeling is when you're moving through these places and understanding, hey, how hard I need to go or how fast I actually go on these things.
Like if I'm,
go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, does that level of awareness really, once you get there, that's how you know you're really developing to the next stage of being an athlete? Because you talked about Rich. I think Rich never consciously thinks about any of these things going on, but he definitely has a genius of feeling exactly when to turn up or turn down.
I think that's ultimately the difference between an elite-level athlete and the rest of us, is their ability to feel. Mm-hmm. They understand what that feeling
words
is.
Words not being put on things, but intuitively knowing when the dial up
and
down.
Yeah, and that's like my wife, who absolutely knows when she can go hard and absolutely knows when she shouldn't and absolutely knows when she needs a day off. Mm. And she'll do more extra stuff than anybody.
And she's an okay athlete, right?
She's decent. She's fair average.
She's trained for the Olympics.
She's fair average.
And everybody knows she's trained for the Olympics.
A big part of that's ego
as well. She got
one of
those yellow medals.
So it's like,
gold medals.
It's like the reason they can be so in tune is because they don't have ego masking that. A lot of times ego keeps you from being able to tune in your body because you're not having to live up to other people's expectations or your perceived expectations
or your
from
own
others.
Limitations.
Yeah, I honestly think ego is the thing that will either stop you from being a better, higher level athlete and it will actually end a career versus like, hey, I'm going to check myself right now. It's like anything. It's business. It's life. It's your relationships with your significant others. It's like, dude, what are you trying to get out of this?
You're suggesting we should check ourselves before we wreck ourselves?
That's right.
Well, how do you know when things are out of balance and when you're doing things the wrong way? Where would you start?
I think progression is ultimately the biggest key. Like, am I progressing? But it's also like, okay, how well am I progressing? And am I just doing this just to do it, or am I doing this to understand it?
Is the progression sustainable, and will it take me where I want to go?
Exactly. And there's no reason why somebody shouldn't go follow some sort of a strength cycle to understand it and educate themselves on it, or doing an endurance cycle and trying to learn from this and understand it, and doing a, you know, whatever, you know, Olympic weightlifting cycle or whatever, and put yourself through these things to understand them so that you know what you're going through and understand the phases of adaptation for yourself, because it's not, it requires humility to understand, hey, I need to rest, even though I really, really want
to
train.
The eye is an important thing. I need to. Not based on what that guy's doing. Learning what is going to work for you. Because the book, everything you read in the book might be the best case for most people most of the time. Like, yeah, 70% about the time, these is what you can see. But ultimately, you have to be aware of what's going on with you. And
exactly.
That's something that takes time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think most of us aren't willing to look at that sometimes. We're just not there.
You think it's tougher for to kind of feel that, I guess, that ceiling that you're hitting with endurance versus strength? Because strength's like, I just can't put any more plates on the bar.
It's very objective.
And I've hit failures.
It moved or didn't.
It's like, me personally, I can tell a huge difference in strength. I'm like very tuned into that. And then when it comes to more like aerobic activities, I'm a dummy.
I think something like a linear strength program is a very easy thing to do, but so is a linear endurance program. Now, how long did it take you to figure out how to utilize something like conjugate system?
It's 10 or 15 years of doing things in a very linear, every day being the same kind of workout thing. And then, it's when you're 20s, now I'm close to 30, I think that's when kind of you figured out, okay, here's how I can unlock what I need most. So quite a bit to get from linear, here's what works for everybody, squat press this 5x5, to highly complex or at least novel combinations of things that seem to work better and that you won't find in a book anywhere.
No, you will not find that. And I think that's ultimately the goal of it. In my opinion, that is ultimately the goal of any athlete, is to get to a point to understand that. That doesn't mean you need to go squat 1,000 pounds like Chris, but that does mean that if you are actually training, you should take enough love for what it is you're doing to actually understand it to that degree. And if you're not, what the fuck? Why are you doing it? Like, what's the point?
Yeah.
Like, you've only got a lifetime. You might as well make the journey enjoyable to understand why you're doing the things.
Just one lifetime.
Well, that's the biggest problem I run into, is it's like, look, I deal with a shit ton of elite level athletes right now. Mm. That's great. That's fine and dandy. They've got ideal goals set in place that we're looking forward to in this next year. The rest of them, the whole lot of everybody, has a life they're looking to live. And it's like,
you look at yourself in a mirror when you're shaving. Like, what you're chasing every day, is it really satisfying? Are you really immersed in it as much as you could be? You know, what are you getting out? Like, are you just dealing? It's like having if you're not going to do what you're saying in the gym, it's like kind of having a job you're committing to for 30 years where every day you're showing up, you're not really giving a shit. You're just like, well, I got to the end of the day again. Boom.
Yeah.
I show up to the gym and I finish the workout. Going home now.
Yeah.
Like, there's only so much you can get out of that.
And you're exactly right. I think, and we all fall into that to a degree, because it's like, hey, you know, I would think everybody sitting at this table right now or standing at this table right now is like, hey, we use training as a means for living a healthy lifestyle to deal with a lot of the day-to-day crap that we deal with.
Yeah.
I was just on the phone yesterday with a good friend and somebody who I program for, and she's like, look, she runs a business. She has two kids, and, I mean, she is type A, hauling ass, like pedal to the metal.
A killer.
And she's like, yo, I was up. My resting heart rate's at 50 this morning. She's like, it's usually low 40s. And I was coughing last night, like all night. Do you think I should train hard today? No, I don't.
She knew it. She knew the answer before
she
gave
the question. You know the answer.
But she goes, well, do you think my resting heart rate has anything to do with me needing? I'm like, look, your resting heart rate is just a byproduct of what the fuck's really going on. That's all it is. It's just telling me that if you actually communicate with me, hey, my resting heart rate's at 50, it's typically in the low 40s. Yeah, that's an issue. We need to back off a little bit. Instead of going high intensity today, you should probably think about going lower intensity and cruising and feeling better versus just going out and slamming it just to get it done so that you think you can feel better about yourself.
So if someone was to track their heart rate, how much over their normal resting heart rate would you consider them to be fatigued or stressed or whatever, however you want to phrase it, to where they should probably back off for that day?
It's interesting to bring that up. We're kind of devising a little device to monitor people, and we're categorizing them into three different categories.
Let's take a break real quick, and we'll find out
what
those three categories
are.
Ooh, cliffhanger.
Boom.
I wonder what category I'm in. Oh, God.
This is Tim Ferriss, and you are listening to Barbell Shrugged. For the video version, go to barbellshrugged.com.
Barbell Shrugged is brought to you by you. To learn more about how you can support the show, go to barbellshrugged.com and sign up for the newsletter.
And we're back with Brian McKenzie, and we're just about to get into these three categories. Whew. Let's not cover them. Let's talk about something else.
No problem. Where do you want to go? So three categories that we've basically found is you're either somebody who is recovers incredibly well. This would be Rich Froning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This would also be Aaron, my wife, Erin, who literally goes to bed and wakes up and she can literally peg it, mm-hmm. right, just every day. Then there's somebody who doesn't recover so well.
You made eye contact with me, by the way.
No. Dude.
Then there's people like, you know.
Not even. Anybody who's squatted as much as you have has to have some phenomenal ability, okay?
Come
That's
on,
not
right.
just somebody something somebody does. At any rate, the other two categories are you're not responding as well. You're somebody who's going to have an up and down heart rate and a more, you know, throughout the week, even though the stressors aren't really changing and you've adapted to that. And then you've got somebody who responds who's really poorly. And this is somebody who's not going to be able to handle as much load or work all the time. And so the variables change for each athlete. And based on those scores, literally we'll deal with resting heart rate, SpO2, a tap test for your central nervous system. For women, we're looking at menstrual cycles because we do know that like right around day 15, 10 to 15, between day 10 and 15, we have great performances. And then about day 18, things start to get a little cray-cray.
Yeah, I'm actually look away at putting it.
I've actually adjusted volume based on the cycle, and that's
absolutely.
Like, it's like an automatic way to periodize.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It just takes more work on the coach. You can't plan as far out.
Yes.
And I guess girls could probably use the app to track that with pretty good consistency. You know exactly how to build
a
training.
We have stuff set up within our stuff where it's like that's just part of the deal.
Yeah,
and it's
cool.
Like when they enter it, it's like once it hits that day 18, guess what? The marker's dropping. But somebody like Aaron, marker doesn't drop it as much. But somebody like, if we had another athlete who's a poor responder, it's like, boom, that's a 5-point drop. So whatever we had to have them do today, it's like, okay, we may need to back her off just a tad.
Yeah.
But the central nervous system, we actually have people doing the tap test, which between that and mood, those are the biggest changers. I think mood is actually the number one predictor of anything. So on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the best
mood.
It's
telling you where your mind's at.
Yeah.
Hard to quantify. You just ask them how you feel?
It's on the thing. It's like from a scale of 1 to 10, where are you at with your mood when you wake up
in the morning?
Well,
it's okay if it's qualitative because whatever they're telling you is where their mind's at. So.
Exactly. Right. For 7 days, we get an average of what it is they're at, right? And we understand where they're at, and the system's learning off of that, including the coach.
Right.
You know,
so speaking of heart rate indicating recovery, you mentioned a minute ago, you gave an example like 20 minutes on a stationary bike and then you can add 20 minutes at some point. But you wanted or suggested that we recover between the 20-minute sessions. Mm-hmm. You guys track how fast you can get your heart rate from 160 down to 120 or whatever it is.
Yep.
And then actually part two to this question is you can answer both at the same time. I know like 10 years ago it used to be really popular for people to do intervals, say I'm running 200-meter sprints or 400-meter sprints, and then instead of saying you're going to rest 3 minutes or you're going to do it every 6 minute on
rest
the 6 minute or whatever, do you wait until your heart rate monitor says you're back at 120 before you run your next interval? You guys ever experimented with that?
I have. Mm-hmm. I have. What was the first part?
The first part was just do you use heart rate recovering as an indicator
so
of...
So that actually parlays right into even the recovery stuff that we're doing on a daily basis to where we want to track how long it's taking them to recover. I have specific standard workouts for the week that we'll have with athletes where I'm having them actually time their recovery just like we're timing whatever distance or something they're doing.
Yeah.
Because I want to see those
physiological... They have to compete against themselves. It's like it's a race for them.
Oh, dude, this is all like... You know, so Mark Devine's really moved into this world, you know, especially with a lot of the stuff he's doing. You guys have done a lot with that.
Yeah.
It's amazing. He's spot on. And we literally, getting the athlete to understand this allows them to really deal with the heart rate variability shit that people are smoked on. Mm-hmm. And when they really get into that state of, I just need to relax right now and control this, like, and they can't, they start to learn that process, whatever they have to go through internally in order to do that. But that really plays into the recovery stuff is because the 1, 2, or 3 score, the person who's taking the longest to recover from specific intervals versus the person who's a 1, it's like the person who's a 1, that heart rate just drops. Like Miguel Indurain, who's arguably one of the greatest cyclists who's ever rode, when he would do the Tour de France, there's these rumors that floated around that he would go and do like something like the Alpe d'Huez or whatever climb he did, pegged, just literally maxed out climbing. He'd get off his bike, and within a minute, his heart was down at 50.
Whoa.
You know, it's just an amazing recoverability process. And Aaron's a lot like that, and I would assume, I only know because I coach and still work with Aaron, but I would assume Rich is exactly that same way, too. It's just, you look at the personality, how they deal with stuff. That is very, like any person
that's
out here.
That's the archetype.
Can you give us an example of, you know, you get your heart rate up to like 170, and what are you measuring? What's good? How long should it take? What's a good score, I guess, to get back down under 100?
Well,
like what's the different heart rate you're looking at?
There's a lot of
different
things.
And then, like, what's
somebody,
good time?
So I've been working with Starrett. He's going to do the Molokai to Oahu. He's 235. He's 235 pounds.
Oh, he's a big boy.
Mm-hmm. He's a big boy. Doing a race that's 32 miles across the Hawaiian Ocean is no fucking joke. So starting him on a lot of this stuff, it's like he gets his heart rate up to 160, 170. How long does it take you to get your heart rate down? Mm. Well, it just kind of sticks at 115, bro. It won't go. And that's the reality of people who tend to be bigger and they bring themselves up like that. It's like, no, we need to actually develop you cardiovascularly more so that you can actually get the get that recoverability going. And so
he responds really well to endurance training, doesn't he?
Oh yeah, he's an aerobic responder. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he's having phenomenal results.
Huge, he has huge base with that kind of training. Right?
Absolutely.
Let's talk about that whole thing when we get done with this.
Yeah, so we actually, with Kelly, and I'll just use him as an example, it's like, look, we started him using 120 as the marker versus I've got athletes like Aaron, we're 99. The moment you hit 99, you go again. Aaron can hit 99 quicker than most athletes that I work with, you know, that hit 120. It's just a dropout, and she's ready to go, and we go again. And that's just telling me she's basically 100% ready to go, recovered for the next interval versus, we're just going to wait 3 minutes. You know, there's a variable difference. Now, for general type programming, you know, we would give a number like, hey, we'll start with a 3-1. You know, we'll go to 3-1 or we'll go to a 6-1 or whatever.
Generalizing, and that works for the average person. But if you're wanting to compete at an elite level, now you got to whip out the heart rate monitor.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Well, I don't even know necessarily that there's too much heart rate monitor training that has to happen with elite level athletes once you've gotten them to understand these things, where I actually think if you actually care enough about what it is you're doing as just a general athlete or somebody who's training to keep themselves healthy, it would behoove you to actually use a heart rate monitor for a little while so that you actually have an understanding to correlate a feeling with, oh, this is what maxed out is.
And once you're seeing the number, you're focusing more there. Then once your focus is on what your heart is doing, then you're paying attention to how you feel. And then all of a sudden, you're more aware of what the hell's going on. Then pretty soon, you can ditch that thing.
This is true. Mm-hmm. And then the flip side of that, unfortunately, and this is one of the problems that I was running into early on within developing CrossFit endurance, was glued to the heart rate monitor. I can't go any harder because I'm going to max out. This is my, 90%. And it's like, dude, if you were going to fucking max out, you wouldn't be talking to me right now. Like you would be, you'd have,
It reminds me if you're lifting weights and you say, I was supposed to do this number. So regardless of how I feel, I'm sticking with that.
Exactly.
Well, today's an opportunity to maybe do more. You can't be glued to whatever the paper said.
Yeah, exactly.
You're
exactly.
here now.
All right. So what does it mean to be an aerobic responder?
Interestingly enough, in bringing up Starrett being an aerobic responder, here's a guy who's 235 pounds, who used to weigh 170 and was a world-class kayaker. Like, literally, the guy was like...
Wow.
Like,
I did not know that.
I didn't know he was that light.
Oh, yeah.
I think a lot of poofy hair in the 80s or
something. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. A lot of Van Halen playing in the rowing training
and
center.
And he got himself up to about a 600-pound squat. You know, I mean, he was legit. I mean, he lifted heavy. He could lift heavy. He still can. And he was a big, big proponent of it. But he was like, dude, I just had my jeans tested.
That was actually the next thing I wanted to bring up.
Yeah, he's like, I'm an aerobic responder. I'm like, makes sense. He's like, what the fuck? How have I progressed the way I have? And I'm like, well, because you actually removed anything aerobic and stuck with everything that would be based on anaerobic, which is why you've also found it hard. But now it's like, this is also why you did well as a world-class water guy. Mm-hmm. Like, This was what you were really good at. So you're actually, with the aerobic response, somebody like Kelly, he can get a lot more aerobic training, and he will maximize his VO2 potential. Mm-hmm. Whatever that VO2 potential means, it doesn't really matter to me. Mm-hmm. It what matters
it
is performance.
You can do a bunch of cardio and get really good at cardio way easier than I can.
Exactly. Where right. if you're a power endurance or a power endurance responder, you're mm-hmm. somebody who's going to do real well mm-hmm. at high intensity intervals with big recoveries or even little recoveries and taking more time off mm-hmm. to bounce back. You're going to maximize your potential that way. Mm-hmm. So literally you're going
to profoundly changes your approach to training.
Yeah.
God.
Be like yes. a good hockey player.
You got it.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Like 45 seconds, hard as you can, come off, recover, go back out hard as you can again. And you can keep doing that all day long.
I am a power responder. Mm. And I've known this my whole life, though. It's mm-hmm. like I swam competitively for roughly 20 years, you know, and it was I cheated every practice because there was no way I was swimming the entire practice for like 2 hours.
No.
I go underwater.
I'm going to back and smoking a cigarette, folks.
And yet,
be back later.
And
talk
yet
to chicks.
I was usually the fastest guy on the team. I was the top sprinter on the team. And it's like, well, how do you do that? And it's like, well, because you are resting and you respond, you know, that's what happens.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not advising that's what we all do, but it's like you can pick up on these things if mm-hmm. you actually pay attention enough.
What are they testing mm-hmm. in this test again?
Yeah, I was going to say, where can someone get genetically tested for this?
The company that I use is called DNA Fit. Mm-hmm. And there's one more, I can't remember the name of it, but that was the one Starrett used, but I use DNA Fit and I actually had mine, and they give you, you can get a nutrition genes tested, and you can get your fitness genes tested.
You swab your cheek or something.
Yeah,
and
you swab your cheek, send it in, and they test it and
easy.
Send it back.
Yeah, these are your genes. These aren't going to change much,
nope.
right?
So that
you are stuck with your genes.
We're all stuck with
our genes,
damn.
Unfortunately.
And there's a way to maximize it.
Okay.
You know, not everybody's going to. That doesn't mean you need to just go train aerobically. It's like it would benefit me based on these markers to train 60% of the time within a power endurance place mm-hmm. versus 40% at just typical aerobic work.
That's important mm-hmm. to know, because if you don't know this key bit of information, or you're not reading the, maybe you don't have to have the test, but maybe you can recognize these cues pretty quickly because you go, okay, that sounds like me. Then now you have an explanation for why you feel like you're continuously going against this invisible wall and training, or like this well-reasoned plan is not, why am I not responding like this guy?
Yes, it's also why a guy like you who might just be an aerobic responder, like a, well, look.
God forbid.
How could it be?
Not just everybody.
Then my inner fat kid goes, that's not the reality. That can't be true.
But somebody like Starrett who lifted heavy enough, and that's what he was doing, and he's like, this is my world. This is where I believe. This is where I live. This is what I am. And it's like, wait a second. Why have I found it hard breathing? So, you know, like he could have added potentially more aerobic or cardiovascular work into his training and he would have benefited more.
Might have gotten stronger.
When you say the heart rate kind of is stalled coming down, is that like in a highest level sense, your body just being very alarmed by the increased aerobic
demand? Yes, stressor, I believe. You know, from my understanding, it's just stressors that the body's unable to let go and really...
It's like in your case, your wife, she's highly skilled at recognizing, here we go again. Effort's over. Cool. Throw down the engines. She's this highly efficient, skillful at coming back down.
Yeah, she's a freak because Aaron's way of dealing with stress is to sleep. If she's upset, if there's something emotionally going on, I'm not joking.
Sometimes like, you're talking over dinner, she just get up and go to bed. You're like,
I'm out. I'm out. And she's like, no. But it's like, I mean, there would be times like when we were training for, you know, London, it was like things got rough. Things got brutal with training. And it's like, you know, the littlest things would set her off. And it was like things got emotional. And it's just like, I'm going to bed. And she would literally be asleep in
her body,
5 minutes.
You know, training is the only
fantastic.
Thing she's
Most
thinking
people
about.
Do the opposite. They're like, I can't sleep. I'm stressed out.
That's what I am. And so I'm not that... That type one where it's like we've got that. I'm more like that 2-3 where I'm a type A, high, you know, going 100 miles an hour, got 100 things going on, and it's like, oh yeah, this is why my heart rate won't drop, or I'm having trouble keeping my fucking, like, my resting heart rate should be a little bit lower, but it's not.
Mm-hmm. Are there any techniques people can use to try to move from 3-2-1?
Yeah. Quite honestly, I think, like, and I brought up the Mark Divine thing, and that's probably been the biggest influencer on me in the last year is more or less meditation and breathing. I do a specific breathing protocol that Laird and I really have gotten into in the last, so I've been hanging, Laird Hamilton. I have been really doing a lot.
The famous surfer.
And
little bit of a hero.
It's been just a revolutionary thing that we've really, like for us, in really developing as, like, that's been the biggest thing I've done in the last year, and I've been training just the same, and I've seen my heart rate go from low 60s to high 40s.
Nice.
And I'm not doing much different, like, other than the breathing and meditation. Mm-hmm. And that's and the way I'm dealing with things too is, like, I take it in and I'm like, oh, I don't need to really react to that right now.
Right.
I need to absorb that and think about it versus, like, bam, bam, bam.
What do you think is the simplest breathing and meditation practice a common athlete could implement in their training?
I think that box, that, you know, the stuff that Mark does is I actually use
the box
that.
Breathing.
Box,
yeah,
breathing.
I actually use that when I'm trying to recover between intervals, because if you guys haven't put a heart rate monitor on when you do that, when you hold the breath and then exhale.
Oh, I can feel it.
Bro, yeah. Your heart rate goes like this.
Well, your consciousness changes too.
Yes.
You get a calming, overwhelming sense of, like, clarity. Like, oh, I know exactly what I should do now that when I open my eyes again.
Yeah.
That's a really powerful
effect.
Yeah,
the stuff that I'm doing is more of a kind of a CO2 scrubbing, where we're actually drawing in a very deep breath and then getting it all out and then repeating that over about 30 to 40 breaths and then going into an exhale and breath holding for anywhere between, you know, 90 seconds to 3 or 4 minutes.
On an exhale.
Yeah, the first time I did this, I held my breath for about 56 seconds, yeah. And then I've gotten, the best I've done is about four minutes and three seconds.
Damn.
But, you know, if you try to hold your breath and you instantly go into panic, what do you think's happening all the time when you even get any kind of stressed in life, but also obviously in a gym?
Yeah.
What do you think's crushing your performance? It's not like your periodization approach.
No.
It's the fact you're freaking out.
Yeah. No,
panic breathing and whatever.
It's literally your breathing. And this is also, ironically, what we've been really looking into from a mechanical standpoint, like I brought up in the beginning about, we've got a runner who's got an anterior tilt, so they're overextended, and then they're trying to run, and they just continue to run, but yet they don't even know how their diaphragm works, because the diaphragm does not work in that position. Oh, guess what? You don't know how to breathe. Let me show you something, which is also why I gravitated towards that training mask. You know, it's like, dude, we put that thing on, and it was like, people were like,
Darth Vader.
Yes, they look like Darth Vader, but the fact is it's forcing that diaphragm to get into position.
Oh,
so
nice.
You change positionally. Hmm. And
it'll change you mechanically.
You're changing that mechanic.
Wow, I've never thought about it like that.
Never
yes.
Does it change?
Oh, yeah.
You have to draw in harder, and this changes your behaviors around breathing?
Yeah, because...
So what you're saying is all connected.
It's totally connected. But even, it's like we do this mobility work, and it's like, I can't breathe in this position where I'm trying to mobilize, and it's like, know why? Because your breath is restricted because you're not in a biomechanical position to be doing that. So you need to figure out how to get your breathing involved and do that.
I've noticed a big difference. I've been using Jill Miller's yoga tune-up balls.
Yep.
And gut smashing.
You know, yeah, first thing in the morning, getting that purple, courageous ball and breathing into that. I mean, just... the simple thing.
You think they're rolling your thighs. You go, I'll roll up my thighs, but you never think about your internal organs getting nasty and affecting your breathing or whatnot.
No,
you never consider chest mechanics. You think weightlifting mechanics or running mechanics, pose.
I feel like I can get a lot more air in after doing that.
Oh, yeah.
It's like shocking after the first time I was like, feel more open.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I will use this training mask. Like, we'll do interval work, but I don't have people using it when they're running or they're working. They throw it on when they're recovering.
Oh.
And we're seeing speedier times through recovery because you're automatically forcing a deeper breath to draw that diaphragm in.
You hyperventilate, you freak out with that thing.
Exactly.
On, I guess, right?
Yeah, but it is a bit of a freak out when you first start using it because you're like, oh, shit, I can't get air in. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, yeah, you're going to need to really draw that in. And it's...
chill out, bro.
Would you suggest I use forcefully inhale and forcefully exhale?
Yep.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that similar to Boss Rutten has that O2 trainer? Is it similar to that?
Very, yeah.
Well, I know that he was saying when he was on the show a year and a half ago, like the difference with what he was doing was for like asthmatics and people that actually had deconditioned muscles, diaphragm included, they would actually be trained because you were forcefully bringing in, forcefully breathing it out, which was subtly different than some of the other masks on the market. And I'm not an expert in that category at all, but how is the mask that you're using?
I just posted... I reposted the gal on my Instagram feed who was very skeptical, who followed our stuff, but very skeptical, and she's an asthmatic.
Mm-hmm.
And she literally finally went out and bought it because I had talked about the breathing mechanics and she had asked, do you think this would help me with my asthma? And I said, I'm not going to tell you it's going to help you with your asthma, but I'll tell you what, if you're not willing to fucking experiment with this, you're never going to know. You she went out and bought it and was like, dude, I can breathe.
Nice.
And that's just, that's what I think the beauty of this training mask actually is, where people are like literally using it for everything and going out on these really long runs or working out all day in it. And it's like, okay, but really just get your breathing mechanics done.
A tool for treating breathing dysfunction is less than a super cool, novel thing you can add to make your endurance training more intense.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's a profoundly different way of looking at it.
That's also what's happening with inside the spectrum of we're pushing too hard and I'm going like a bat out of hell, like, and I don't understand pacing. Oh, let's throw this mask on. This will slow you down.
It's funny how one of the most important things you can add to your training is a tool not to speed you up but slow you down.
Yeah, yeah. So Starrett and I recently just did we had to redo our level ones. And so we did the level one, and there's a workout that typically happens. They do the burpee thruster workout. And our goal with each other was, so he counted my reps and I counted his. He's like, here's the deal. You can only breathe through your nose the entire time.
Mm.
That's it. And so that was the goal. And I was easily nowhere near being one of the fittest people in that room.
Mm.
There were 60 people, right? And we did it, and I literally finished, I think, third in that workout by breathing through my nose. And that's just a testament to, oh, if I'm actually breathing and I'm not blowing it out and having to stop and understand, just pace it. I'm not the fittest. I know, like,
I'm gonna try that on trail runs. I do a trail run, like a 45-minute to an hour trail run once a week right now, and I think I'm going to try the breathing just through my nose on my next trail run to see how it goes.
I'll send you guys a mask.
Send me a mask.
I'll tape your mouth shut.
I'll video.
That's right.
I'll video him passing out on the trail. it's working.
Podcast host passes out, falls into cliff while doing trail run.
Yeah.
I did a handstand next to a cliff in Peru a couple days ago.
I saw a picture of that.
Freaked out everyone that was there. Just seeing people like running from him like they were going to get hurt.
Yeah, people were like, oh my God. I'm like, it's me. Two guys. I wasn't very happy about it.
Why are you guys
panicking? Look, everybody, I'm so fit. Relax. Come on.
Can't you see these abs?
Yeah, look at them. They're so defined. Knuckle deep you go on these abs.
Wow.
All right, let's wrap this up. Brian, where can people find you?
Instagram and Twitter at I am unscared, athletecell.com, crossfitendurance.com, and of course, ThreeFuel.
Trace Fuel.
We've talked
Trace
about that
Fuel,
before.
Trace L.
Yes.
Look in the show notes on barbellshrug.com for all the links, folks.
Yes. Thank you.
Good being here.
Thanks for coming on
Cheers,
the show.
Man.
All right, awesome.